Iran's leader says Washington's promises have no credibility and Tehran will return to its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal only if the U.S. lifts all its unilateral sanctions. The Yemeni army says it has killed or injured over 10,000 Saudi-backed forces in retaliatory operations against Saudi Arabia over the past 6 years. And Germany is considering extending anti-coronavirus restrictions into April as the country battles a third wave of the disease. And welcome from Tehran, you've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran this hour, where the leader of the Islamic Revolution says if the U.S. practically lifts all of its sanctions, Iran will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Now, that's known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran does not trust U.S. promises on removing the sanctions, saying its pledges have no credibility. The leader said the administration of former President Barack Obama did not lift sanctions in practice, although Iran fulfilled all of its commitments. Ayatollah Khamenei also touched upon the maximum pressure campaign launched by Donald Trump, saying it failed and disgrace the U.S. Iran's leader warned that Joe Biden's administration will fail also if it continues that campaign. Ayatollah Khamenei called U.S. sanctions against countries a big crime as they hinder access to food and medicine. He said in Iran, young people have turned U.S. sanctions into opportunities by producing goods that had to be imported before. I'd like to welcome my guests to this special look at the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution. I'd like to welcome Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London, and Yahya Jahangiri, international lecturer out of Zanjan. Thank you both for being with us, starting it off in London. And Sayed Mohsen, I mean, the speech was one would say very much resistance-oriented and very much filled with optimism. Your assessment of the overall, you think, the main points of this speech were?
Well, I think the main point is not trusting the United States, and it's based on very wise, logical, historical realities. The Americans have, since a very, very long time, a really terrible history in reneging on history, on reneging on treaties. Of course, we can go back as far as they're reneging on the native Indians and the way they reneged on treaties from that period in their early history, through to the Trans-Pacific Treaty for economics and agreements around of that kind, the Trans-Pacific Agreements. Now, in between, they've reneged on the climate change agreements, the Paris climate change agreements. The list goes on. I could list more and more. So there's the first, I think, priority, that the Islamic Republic of Iran's policies, whilst being magnanimous, I think, in terms of giving the Americans the benefit of the doubt, even in going into the JCPOA, given their track record of, if you like, outright animosity and diabolical machinations against Iran over several decades since 1979, they've yet given them an opportunity. And again, all that the Americans prove is that you can't basically trust any treaty that they make with you. It's not worth the paper it's written on. And Ayatollah Khamenei has emphasized this to be a thought process within the Iranian political mechanism as well, that actually you've got to have wisdom and you've got to understand who you're dealing with. If the Americans are to prove worthy signatories of any treaty, first of all, they've got to put forward all the credentials they can to convince Iran now that actually they mean what they say and they're going to do what they say. And that would mean making massive concessions in terms of all of the economic terrorism, the sanctions that they've imposed on Iran, and the rest.
Well, Yahya, your take, you've heard Sayed Mohsen just talked about economic terrorism. I want to start from there and looking at that aspect and dealing with this economic terrorism Ayatollah Khamenei has said that the young people in this country has actually turned that hardship into opportunity. And he talked about the development and the invention of so many of the needs of the country that's now being taken care of domestically.
Yeah. Actually, the speech of the leader in the beginning of the year is a kind of official announcement for the Iranian authorities, for the all parties in Iran to accept it. So what the leader today highlighted regarding to the sanction and the next step regarding the JCPOA shows that Iranian policy in future how would be. And what was very important point and a key point in the speech of the leader was that we don't look the commitment on the paper. What we look is we want to see on the in the action. And what during the this 4 decades took place regarding to Iran is that day by day we saw the sanction. One of the important points in his speech was that even in the COVID by the COVID, we saw that even the masks was forbidden and was included under the sanction against the Iranian. And what today we see regarding to the sanction against Iran, it is unhumanitarian. And today, if we one of the important points also in the speech of the leader was that we it is not the point to say that who have to start, who have to be the beginner. The important point is that we all have to confirm by action our commitment to the JCPOA.
Okay. Said Mohsen, when we look at the situation, as you had said earlier, that if, even prior to, of course, the JCPOA, going back historically with the United States and basically not keeping their commitments, if your prognosis of where this is going at this point, I mean, the leader has shown skepticism time and time again, and said, of course, from the very beginning that he did not think that they would abide by it. And even now, he is skeptical that they won't, but of course still saying that if they basically take away all unilateral sanctions, cancel all unilateral sanctions, in practice, still, Iran is willing to return, fulfill all of its commitments under the JCPOA if the United States returns and does what it's supposed to do. Your perspective in general about this, are you skeptical that this is going to happen, that the United States will actually cancel all the unilateral sanctions on Iran, or your overall perspective on this?
I'm hugely skeptical about that. The fact is that the Americans have a very clear target in terms of their strategic dialogue with Iran. The first is that the Islamic Republic of Iran should not be a regional power. It should have no influence in the region that rivals theirs or Israel. That's number one. Number two is they do not want the Islamic Republic of Iran to have a defense capability which prevents Israel and themselves bullying and dominating in an oppressive way that region in order to resource rape. Of course, they also don't want the Islamic Republic of Iran to be a success because the lie of democracy which they've sold around the world is actually, of course, we all know, an imperialistic totalitarianism, only not in so many obvious, if you like, words. But Iran offers potentially an alternative because the Islamic Republic of Iran hasn't gone to war with anybody in its region or as an offensive war over 200 years. They have a long history of cultural, literary, political, and other benefits that they've given to the entire West Asian region over the history. And of course, the most important thing for the Americans and the Israelis is that Islamic Republic of Iran has an ideology, a political ideology and philosophy based on a moral outlook, one which diametrically opposes American imperialism, Israeli imperialism. That they know perfectly well they can never really have treaties that they can abide with Iran, because they fundamentally differ in terms of their moral principles politically. And Iran is going to be a thorn in their side. Until they remove that thorn, as far as they're concerned, they cannot rest. So I really don't see any, I don't see any reason for the Americans to come to a genuine agreement with Iran, other than through fear and through the power of Iran and through its own self-sustainability, which it's achieving. And Ayatollah Khamenei has hinted at this. He said very clearly, rely on yourselves. Start building those scientific, technological, agricultural, economic self-sustainability. Turn to the East. China and Russia are offering friendship in terms of economic and other aid as well. Don't rely on the Americans. This kind of obsession that that you have to get the ratification of America, it must end, because it's a sort of a neo-colonialist mindset, which may still exist in some circles. It will not give you any benefits, just as it's not given you any benefits over the last four decades.
And with that, I appreciate both of you being with us. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London, and Yahya Jahangiri, international lecturer out of Zanjan. Moving on to other news this hour, Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Saadi says Saudi Arabia has launched more than 260,000 airstrikes on his country since it began its war in 2015. Saadi said the Yemeni army, in response, has conducted over 12,000 operations against Saudi Arabia. He said over 10,000 Saudi-backed forces had been killed or injured as a result. The Yemeni army spokesman also said his country conducted at least 1,300 ballistic missile attacks against Saudi targets. He said the army will continue to defend Yemen until the Saudi aggression comes to an end. Riyadh began its war on March the 26th, 2015. The UN says more than 250,000 Yemenis have died so far, most of them from indirect causes such as starvation. And now to Germany, where the chancellor there, Angela Merkel, is seeking to extend COVID-19 restrictions into April after infections jump due to new variants of the virus. The German government is also considering making all people returning from abroad face quarantine and compulsory coronavirus tests. The measures will be discussed on Monday. Public fatigue over lockdown measures, now in their fourth month, is growing in Germany. On Saturday, arrests were made as some 20,000 people gathered in the city of Kassel to protest the restrictions. Police deployed water cannons and used pepper spray to disperse protesters. They fought back, hitting officers with projectiles. Germany is one of the hardest hit European nations by the pandemic. Myanmar's coup leader says the main duty of the armed forces is to defend the country against external threats. General Min Aung Hlaing made the comments as he visited the armed forces on the strategically important Cocoa Islands. The remarks come as international pressure is growing on Myanmar's junta to stop its crackdown on anti-coup protesters. The junta, however, has remained defiant as protests continue. On Sunday, a man was killed and several others wounded in the central town of Manhwa. Police opened a fire on a group of people setting up a barricade there. Activist groups say nearly 250 people have been killed since the coup on February the 1st. Over 2,300 have also been arrested. Now to Kashmir, where people in the Indian-administered Kashmir are in a festive mood with the arrival of spring after witnessing prolonged lockdowns and a harsh winter. They mark the first day of spring with celebrations and festivities. Our correspondent, Shahana Butt, brings us more.
For decades now, people of Kashmir haven't witnessed any celebrations. The conflict in the region has always spoiled their joy and happiness. However, when it comes to Nowruz festival, which marks the beginning of spring, hope for a better tomorrow gives people of this war-weary region a chance to rejoice. Now people have gathered in the heart of Kashmir's capital city of Srinagar, where almond trees are blossoming to mark the arrival of spring.
People of Kashmir have nothing to rejoice, and we have faced turmoil for decades. But when we see the cycle of life in nature and how life is revived, I and many like me begin to revive too. We only hope to have a spring year round, since we have missed it for decades.
Youngsters are busy clicking on images and filling their social media timelines, while others are enjoying the beauty of fresh blooms. And to add to this glory, Kashmir's administration has organized a concert.
Spring will soon begin, and we wanted to start on a happy note. We want people of Kashmir to be full of hope, energy and enthusiasm, so that this energy boosts their morale throughout the year.
Nowruz, a Persian tradition of welcoming spring, became part of the culture of Kashmir after Persian scholars and saints came to Kashmir and preached Islamic teachings centuries ago. Since then, Kashmir and Persia have shared many similarities, including food. Here at the Little Persia, friends and families have gathered in Kashmir's only Persian food-serving restaurant to celebrate the occasion of Nowruz. The owner says the practice aims to retain the fantastic culture of Persia through food. Picturesque Kashmir, known as the Venice of East, attracts tourists from around the globe. However, decades of turmoil and now the COVID-19 pandemic have pushed the region's economy to its ever lowest. Nowruz symbolizes hope, revival and life. People of Kashmir say no one other than those suffering in this world would realize the importance of a new beginning, and they only hope to see their spring season last long. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Innovative solutions to lack of access to technology and the internet were required to make online learning work, says Sarah Berry, researcher, in an article published under the heading, What Pandemic Has Taught Us About Education Technology. Stay tuned for more. The pandemic has brought havoc into the lives of many, personally and professionally. Loss of lives, lifestyles, jobs, routines, rhythms, and with it all, so much more. The list is endless. The domain of education is no different. Where education imparted in schools was heavily dependent on human interaction, it shifted to a situation where a fine balance was maintained between human and tech intervention, to a situation where education technology became a must. This domain has indeed witnessed a paradigm shift. According to the UNESCO Institute for Statistics, the COVID-19 pandemic has led to the closure of schools in 188 countries, affecting more than 1.5 billion students and 63 million primary and secondary teachers worldwide. These are mind-boggling figures, and the question that pops up spontaneously is how diverse stakeholders in the domain of education have coped with the loss of jobs, the shift to online teachings and learning, conducting and appearing for exams, maintaining interaction with peers during lockdowns and thereafter, while maintaining social distancing, adjusting to designing and delivering curricula, and so much more. One acknowledged fact, however, remains. Access to the required tech equipment, stable internet connections, and consistent electricity supply was necessary for the smooth and regular conduct of online classes. According to McKinsey, India had 560 million internet subscribers in September 2018, second only to China. Indians download more apps, 12.3 billion in 2018, than any other country except China, and spend more time on social media, an average of 17 hours a week, than social media users in China and the United States. On the other hand, India's digital divide remains huge, as more than 400 million people still have no access to the internet. Divide is also huge, with the internet density in rural areas, where more than 60% of the people live, is still low at 25% compared with the internet density in urban areas, that is about 90%. The digital divide is also big across the leading and lagging regions, with states like Bihar and Uttar Pradesh with very low internet use density. General digital divide is also huge within India, with far fewer women with access to mobile phones and the internet services. The pandemic has also served as an opportunity to rethink challenges in order to find innovative and customized solutions. So, if electricity supply and internet access are erratic, and or if the target audience has limited or no access to smartphone, how can regularity in education be ensured? One solution that emerged in India, for example, was dissemination via IVR, that is, interactive voice response, which found resonance despite initial hiccups. In situations where even this was not possible, dissemination of education while maintaining social distancing was implemented once the lockdown was eased. In either case, it was not a substitute for the regular bricks and mortar model, but what did happen was that the link with formal education was not completely broken. A 14-year-old pupil remarked, "I didn't have consistent access to smartphone once the lockdown eased and my parents resumed work, but what worked for me were fixed hours during which the phone was with me, and I could take instructions from my teachers and discuss the work given prior and which I had attempted subsequently." Another young student residing in an urban slum couldn't attend regular online classes but found a way of joining one of her fellow students a few houses away where internet connectivity was more stable. at the end of the day, it also depends on how committed one is to complete one's education or, in other words, remain in touch with what's happening in the virtual classroom, she said. We even discuss problems and solutions in a common WhatsApp group. These challenges were not limited to the classroom and studies only, but also other mental and emotional issues. We all became like an extended family. What also needs to be understood is that designing and imparting of curricula need to be fine-tuned. One size does not fit all, especially in an extremely diverse country. So how does one address this? A life and soft skills trainer reminisced about one of her online batches. At the beginning, I was nervous. I am a technically challenged person. I hadn't met any batch personally, and I had to teach them verbal English communication skills. I took it step by step. I learned what I could be beforehand in terms of technicalities. Some I learned during my journey with the help of my students and with others. We, my students and I, jointly found a solution to. The idea is not to know everything. One can't. Just accept that. What I ensured was that the video option was on and the sessions were heavy on interaction, which is what a normal class should also be like. A language teacher also said, I, as a child, always learned better when I learned via fun and doing, rather than rote. Of course, when I was a child, there was not much choice, rote being the mode. Now things have changed drastically and for the better. Curricula design is being given the attention it deserves, and content development is an art and a science. If we make learning fun and entertainment, encouraging children to explore and learn, with technology serving as a facilitator for both children and teachers, then that is an ideal situation. Of course, online classes can be exhausting to the mind and the body. Hence, correct posture, optimum number of breaks, quality me time, study at your own pace models, platforms, and such have helped address the challenge of mental and physical stress to some extent. However, caution is still advised in order to strike that delicate balance. Valuable inputs such as the above are part of a quantitative and qualitative data that help improvise teaching and learning processes. And the crux of this lies in data, its collection, filtering, and extrapolation. McKinsey report says every 3 years, the OECD uses PISA, that is the Program for International Student Assessment, to test the 15-year-olds around the world on math, reading, and science. What makes these tests so powerful is that they go beyond the numbers, asking students, principals, teachers, and parents a series of questions about their attitudes, behaviors, and resources. An optional student survey on information and communications technology, ICT, asks specifically about technology use in a classroom, for homework, and more broadly. In 2018, more than 340,000 students in 51 countries took the ICT survey, providing a rich data set for analyzing key questions about technology use in schools. How much is technology being used in schools? Which technologies are having a positive impact on student outcomes? What is the optimal amount of time to spend using devices in classroom and for homework? How does this vary across different countries and regions around the world? The importance of data can be gathered from what mentioned, which goes to emphasize the importance of collection of the right kind of quality data in an efficient and non-partial and timely fashion in order to impact policymaking and implementation for the empowerment of those who hold the future. Having said, the main element remains balance, a balance between the contributions of diverse stakeholders in the education ecosystem, a balance between the application and contribution of technology and physical interaction in the domain of education, and a balance between what constitutes education and its dissemination. Though this is a thin line to walk, it is essential to execute more so now than ever before, thanks to the pandemic and the changes it has propelled around the world.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, or you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين. The work of Imam al-Hussein was to move towards, in order to guide people as he is guiding individuals on a social scale, to bring the ummah, all those hundreds of thousands at the time, perhaps millions, I'm not sure what the figures were back then, to guide all of them and prevent them from being misled by being given misinformation. There were times that in the name of Islam, brothers and sisters, on the pulpit of the Prophet, in every major city in the Muslim world that extended from North Africa all the way to Central Asia, every major city cursed Amir al-Mu'mineen, salawatullah wa salamu alayhi, in the name of Islam. This is what governance can do. And all those people who heard this were poisoned with that misinformation. The world today, the governance of the world today, brothers and sisters, is the cause of all these billions of people getting misinformed about Islam and thinking these different thoughts about what Islam actually is, being misled, being kept busy with materialism, distracted with a fun little thing here and fun little thing there, taking the lives of people and their concerns to be limited to this material realm, and subconsciously being fed this misinformation that God is not there and resurrection is not true. This is being fed. People are being brainwashed. Unfortunately, a lot of us have been brainwashed by this global governance into thinking that when Muslims are teaching their children the fact that God exists and He is in charge and He's the only God and no one else is in charge, they think that this is brainwashing. And they say in order for it not to be brainwashing, you need to provide reasons. And for people in every line of every science book to use language and wording that makes people think of this world in a way where every molecule, every subatomic particle is its own being that somehow haphazardly, with some coincidence, has ended up where it is, and this entire system is functioning. This is being fed to people. They're being brainwashed. This is not being seen. People are being brainwashed against Islam. People are being brainwashed against Muslims. People are being brainwashed against what Islam is. It's the American and the Western global, you've heard this language, the global, the New World Order after the World War, the Second World War as they called it, the International War, these powers that were the most powerful nations or governments at the time, they fought each other and a couple of them one over the others, and then they started fighting in the Cold War, and then one superpower. This world order is governance. It is this world order that forms public opinion. The mainstream media and social media. Social media is a tool at their disposal. YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, all of these forms of social media and whatever else is created is under their control. When they want, they will use Facebook to get people to come and participate in the elections. You've seen that. They encourage every person to come and participate in this phony elections in this country. When it comes to the elections in other countries, particularly in the Islamic Republic, the same Facebook is used to encourage people not to go, to tell people that that is not a democracy, that your votes do not count, that this is all a game. Social media is a tool at their disposal. They created the second fabricated Egyptian revolution. It wasn't a real revolution. It wasn't what the people wanted. People didn't want another dictator. That's exactly what Assisi is. Who brought those people to the street? Well, the people who are in charge of Facebook, and they know how to do it. Well, social media, these different, Facebook is one example. People are being brainwashed by this world order, this global governance. People are being told. CNN goes into these countries, BBC goes into these countries, Fox and all these different news outlets, and then they create these other ones for other languages. There is a list of Farsi outlets that have been created to manipulate Farsi-speaking people. There are a list of outlets that have been created in Arabic, whether it's directly by these people or by governments that are completely under their control, like the Saudi government, like the Qatari government, like the Emirati government. These governments are. Al Jazeera is not a Muslim outlet speaking based on the principles of Islam. It has nothing to do with that. It's another version of Western media in the Arabic language, though, or the English language. They've created both of those. They brainwash people. They brainwash people. They brainwash Muslims. That's what they're doing. If the world is to be guided in the direction of Allah, if all of these masses are to be guided in the direction of Allah to receive actual information, not misinformation in the form of information, then the world order has got to be the world order of Allah, led by the Imam appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's what the Imams were working towards. That's what Imam al-Hussein was working towards. He wasn't only looking even at that government, the regions that the Muslim government at the time was governing. Imam al-Hussein, based on the teachings of Islam, of the Quran, that we're supposed to make sure that any tyranny, any other government which is a tyranny, is prevented from misinforming their people, mistreating their people, causing injustice, intellectual injustice.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
CO2 is not a lone actor. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "We're Destroying Our Life Support Systems." Studies suggest the Amazon now contributes to warming. Stay tuned for the details, please. While recent research has raised alarm that tropical forests, including the Amazon, could soon stop serving as carbon sinks, a first-of-its-kind study from 30 experts that takes into account other greenhouse gases suggests the world's largest rainforest may already be contributing to the warming of the planet. The new analysis, published recently in the journal Frontiers in Forest and Global Change, considers not only carbon dioxide, CO2, and its impact on the global climate, but also that of methane, CH4, nitrous oxide, N20, black carbon, biogenic volatile organic compounds, BVOCs, aerosols, evapotranspiration, and albedo. What the authors do that's important is to expand the conversation beyond carbon dioxide, which is what 90% of public conversation is centered around. Patrick McGonigal, Associate Director of Research at Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, told National Geographic, CO2 is not a lone actor, added McGonigal, who was cited in but not involved with the research, which was funded by the National Geographic Society. When you consider the whole cast of other characters, the outlook in the Amazon is that the impacts of human activities will be worse than we realize. As 15-year-old climate activist Alexandria Villasnor put it in a tweet about the study, we are destroying our life support systems. We are running out of time. The recent study notes that after a transient period of reduced deforestation and increased optimism, rising agricultural conversion and illegal logging activities are again accelerating Amazonian forest loss. This resurgence has renewed concerns that the region is rapidly approaching a catastrophic tipping point. Data from the Rainforest Foundation Norway revealed recently that human activities have destroyed 34% of old-growth tropical rainforest and degraded 30% worldwide. Over half of that destruction since 2002 has been in the Amazon and neighboring South American rainforest. Under Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, whose country is home to the majority of the Amazon, deforestation hit a 12-year high in 2020. Cutting the forest is interfering with its carbon uptake. That's a problem. Christopher Covey, lead author of the new study and a professor of environmental studies at Skidmore College, told National Geographic. But when you start to look at these other factors alongside CO2, it gets really hard to see how the net effect isn't that the Amazon as a whole is really warming global climate. The study says that despite some uncertainty, we conclude that current warming from non-CO2 agents, especially CH4 and N2O, in the Amazon basin largely offsets and most likely exceeds the climate service provided by atmospheric CO2 uptake. We also find that the majority of anthropogenic impacts act to increase the radioactive forcing potential of the basin. Given the large contribution of less recognized agents, the paper continues, noting that Amazonian trees alone emit about 3.5% of all global CH4, focusing strictly on carbon uptake and storage is incompatible with genuine efforts to understand and manage the biochemistry of climate in a rapidly changing Amazon basin. Covey and his colleagues told National Geographic that reversing the damage that's already been done will require halting emissions from fossil fuels around the world and reining in Amazon deforestation, along with reducing dam building and increasing efforts to replant trees. The Amazon is among the most biodiverse places on the planet. The ongoing coronavirus pandemic has highlighted the importance of conserving and restoring rainforest, not only because of the climate emergency, but also to prevent future zoonotic disease outbreaks. As the pandemic, officially declared a year ago, has killed more than 2.6 million people and sickened over 119 million worldwide, experts from across the globe have repeatedly called on humanity to heal its broken relationship with nature.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly.
What I want to say is that when the Islamic government was established, it brought up certain ideals derived once again from Islam and the Holy Quran. Before the formation of the Islamic government, they used to be mentioned in the form of a dream. Some people might have thought about them as unattainable dreams. Ideals such as administration of justice, lack of tolerance in the face of oppression, the non-existence of arrogance and oppression, leading a pure life, the moral transcendence of humans, and other such virtues and ideals. These are Islamic ideals, and they have been brought up by the Islamic Republic. but before the revolution, they could not be implemented in practice. Well, in order to attain these ideals, certain tools are needed.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
اون ابزارها هم که ما رو به اون آرمانها برسانه باز در خود منظومه معرفتی اسلام وجود داره بلا شک.
The tools needed to help us attain those ideals exist undoubtedly in the ideological system of Islam, because it is impossible for Islam to introduce us to a certain destination and to encourage us to reach that destination without showing us the path. Such a thing is impossible. The path has been showed to us in the book and in the sunnah. Now, the Islamic government wants to reach those ideals. Therefore, it should look for and find the tools and instruments for achieving that goal, which are part of the spiritual and ideological concepts of Islam. Then, it should use them and move forward. In fact, they are software for the hardware of the Islamic government. If you consider the Islamic government as a hardware, without a suitable software, it will not be of any value. The software is the ways and methods for achieving the ideals and the continuation of the path. Therefore, what I want to say today is that the Islamic government needs such a software.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.